Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 138 of the Gunblog Variety Cast, a proud member of the Self Defense Radio Network. How are you doing, Aaron?
Well, honestly, I am a bit bummed right now. I was all set to put an advertisement for Operation Blazing Sword in a publication for an event called Out Raleigh, which is a big, well, I guess we'll call it a gay pride event.
Yeah, I think we can call it that, yeah.
And we were going to be put in what is essentially a gay Yellow Pages. I mean, I'm probably doing a horrible disservice of it, but it's listed as being full of resources for the LGBTQ community. And so I thought this was great, a way to get our message out specifically to the audience we want. And I was very excited that we would be able to buy our first ad. And so we got the ad made up. It was an Oleg Volk creation. It looked beautiful. I submitted it before the deadline. And then I didn't hear anything. And I finally called and pestered someone. And I was told that a few days before the deadline, they had received just a flood of submissions. And so they cut off the ads and we aren't getting in. So Aaron has a sad.
Is there any chance that they just looked at the ad and went, no way, we're not putting that in there?
There is a chance, but I have no way of knowing. You know, I don't think they would actually tell me that. So it's possible. I don't know. Hopefully, maybe you and your friend John can get a table at Out Raleigh and pass out Blazing Sword posters and literature and things like that. That'd be really cool.
Yeah, I think John was working on something like that. And if he manages to do that, I'll go with him. I think it'd be cool. A good idea. I'll even wear my purple shirt.
Aw. And the other news going on in Blazing Sword is that I am apparently very popular in Europe, and I don't know why. A few weeks ago, I was contacted by someone from Channel 4 in the UK, and they're doing a documentary on LGBTQ and guns. And I specifically say that in a breathless fashion because that was the impression I got, that whole, oh my God, hate crimes are on the rise, Trump is in power, we've got to get guns. And so they were doing an investigation on that. Then last week I was contacted by someone in Israel who works for the newspaper Haaretz. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation.
I believe it's Haaretz, but then again, I could be butchering it too, so.
But anyway, that is supposed to be essentially the New York Times of Israel.
It is, yes. It's the paper of record.
Ah, okay. And so I was asked about the Blazing Sword and just, you know, the general type of interview. And then as soon as I got off Skype with this person, I received another email from someone in Sweden wanting to talk to me about Blazing Sword and LGBTQ people with guns. You know, the popularity is great, don't get me wrong. I'm just wondering what the heck happened that suddenly people in Europe were wanting to talk to me when, you know, for all the time previous to this, no one really noticed or cared. I really want to know what one thing they saw or heard, or if someone said something. I want to know that first domino.
Apparently they're listening to the podcast, Aaron.
Well, of course. That definitely has to be it.
Well, I tell you what, there's two things that you need to do when you do these interviews. Number one, you need to remind everybody, this is a charity. Send us your money, right?
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, got to get that out. Even if it's a European publication, Americans are going to read it. And they're going to say, oh, that's a great idea.
And the second is to plug the podcast?
Yes, you must plug the podcast. Get everybody listening to the podcast because you're a draw now. I would just like to point out that I knew this was going to happen long ago. Erin is going to be really popular, so we should make her the co-host. Yeah, that's the best person because she'll be a bigger draw as the co-host than just a contributor. So,
well, thank you, Adam, then, for falling on your swords that I could be the new co-host.
Speaking of Adam, we're going to see him coming up at NRA annual meeting.
We are, and I'm very nervous-sighted about that because he's a good guy and I like him, but there's a part of me that desperately wants to know if he's been listening to the podcast and if he thinks I'm doing a good job. And there's part of me that really doesn't want to know because I'm afraid he'll say, no, you're doing a horrible job, and then I'll feel awful.
Well, Adam, since you're listening, probably, maybe, go to gunblogvarietycast.com and look in the contacts tab at the top and send Aaron a little contact saying, A, doing a great job, and B, more ponies.
Yeah, the answer is always more ponies.
What were the answers? Yes or in hell yes?
Yeah, something like that. So how are you doing, Sean?
I do pretty well. I am, I think, 5 classes into the doggy dog training thing. It's a distraction class, you know, how to keep your dog engaged and doing what it's supposed to do when there's distractions around. Because we all know your dog will listen to you inside your house when there's nothing going on. But the minute you take your dog outside the house, your dog's like, oh, squirrel. Oh, squirrel. Oh, look, something flying through the air. I should chase it. How are you going to chase it? It's in the air. You can't fly. My dog thinks crows are pretty interesting.
So does mine. Also, we have turkey vultures in the area. And Heath goes nuts. If he could sprout wings to chase them, he would. He just goes berserk when they're, I mean, they don't even have to be in the yard. They're just in the trees next to the yard. But, you know, this aggression, this, it cannot stand, man. And it just barks his full head off.
Yeah, well, we've got one more real class, and then we have the test. She's going to get the Canine Good Citizen test. We shouldn't have any real trouble with the CGC. Now, of course, I've gone and said that, and I'm going to screw it up. It's not the dog's fault. It won't be the dog's fault if we screw it up. The dog knows what to do. It's maybe the handler isn't, 100%. Because that's what it turns out. As long as I do my bit, the dog's fine. It's like shooting in a way. The gun is accurate. It's the loose nut behind the trigger that's having the problem. So we shouldn't have any trouble with that. The whole point of this training is I want to get to the point where I can take her and teach her, or actually go to a class, somebody else help me teach her, the agility stuff, you know, where they run through the weave poles and go over stuff. And I think she'd have a good time with that. So we're going to see if that works out. The other thing that's going on is I just bought some lock picks.
Really? Are you planning on breaking and entering?
Well, the podcast isn't working out. I'm thinking about starting a life of crime. No, actually, I'm just going to learn how to pick locks because it sounds interesting. I said something, I don't know when it was, I'd said something about how it might be useful in my professional life of, you know, people having to find keys and unlock things and they never have the key, or they try 67 different keys and it was the second key was the good key, but it didn't work for them. So they have to work through all their keys on the key. Some of the people I deal with, they look like, you know, high school janitors from, you know, the 80s with these rings of keys that you can hear all the way across the school. And I just think it would be so much easier if I could just whip out a set of lock picks and pick the lock. I think I said something like that to Weird. And Weird's like, oh, well, check out this website. It's called Lock Lab. And you can learn how to pick locks just from watching YouTube videos. And I'm watching this guy pick locks. And I'm like, it don't look that hard. I mean, it looks pretty simple, actually, for like the basic locks, the ones that don't have like fancy security features in them. Apparently, master locks are a joke. I did not know this. But I mean, he's just like click, 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 boom, and the lock opens up. I was like, that's really cool. I'd love to learn how to do that. So I bought myself a set of lock picks for $50 for a really nice set of lock picks. Figure buy once, cry once. And since it was like $60, you got free shipping. I picked up another $15 worth of these 2 practice locks. So like, don't practice on the lock at your house. You don't normally damage a lock by picking it, but why take a chance on your own lock at your house? So, you know, I guess I got to learn. And then once I've learned, I might pick the lock on my house just to see if I can, but not as a regular practice.
All right. I really look forward to hearing your review of that because that's a skill I'm interested in learning too, but the price has always been an obstacle for me. So if you like them, I'll go ahead and save up and buy them and learn how to do it myself.
Well, cool. I'll bring them along with me to NRA annual meeting, and I'll tell Weird to bring some stuff along too, and maybe we can play with some locks.
Cool. Thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of the Gunblog Variety Cast. From Golden Saber to range rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
All right, let's get on with the show.
Beth is at the USCCA Expo in Fort Worth, Texas, and she'll tell us about all the awesome activities and events to be found there this weekend.
This weekend, I had the privilege of being part of the third annual USCCA Concealed Carry Expo, this one taking place in the beautiful Fort Worth, Texas. And of course, just like we always do, we have plenty of amazing vendors with products and services and innovations, and then we have a host of great speakers. This year as well, we incorporated something brand new just for the women, kind of like a living classroom environment in which they could come in and see all the great products that were geared just toward them without any sales pressure. So they could come in and ask questions. We had dressing rooms where they could try things on. We even had an area where there were a lot of great clothing options for ladies who do choose the concealed carry lifestyle. We know that it takes sometimes a little clever wardrobe manipulation to be able to hide that pistol, whether semi-automatic or revolver. And of course, we did show a lot of options for off-body carry, and we support that as long as people are going to make the commitment to do so responsibly. Some of the women that came through the women's section included Natalie Foster, Antonia Okafor, Carrie Lightfoot, Juliana Crowder. So there were women basically representing so many different aspects of Second Amendment support and advocacy. And of course, it was really fun when Gabby Franco popped in for a little while. She is such an amazing shooter, but she has such an amazing spirit and a passion for America. We also, of course, got to see Sheriff David Clark and Steven Crowder, who was the entertainment for our very first Second Amendment Awards. Basically, it was a weekend full of all the amazing things that you could ask about, train about, learn about, buy, or use when it comes to concealed carry. And of course, that's what the USCCA is all about. Yes, we do offer self-defense insurance, but we love the training and education portion of it. And I know that people from all over were learning some amazing things. And I know I do. I always learn something new. I didn't get to attend any seminars. I was busy helping with the women's panel discussion and sharing some things about situational awareness and really just how to get involved with the Second Amendment, within your own family, within your community, or even on a broader scale. A lot of ladies were able to ask us questions personally, share their stories of things that had happened to them, things that they had to overcome. And of course, they were able to really see, touch, and feel a lot of great products and items that they could add to their gear or possibly just continue to test out until they found something that was right for them. It was amazing to meet ladies like Randy Rogers, who is a competitive shooter and who has been around firearms basically her entire life and who has also been competing almost her entire life. But it was also just as fantastic to meet all the ladies who had never shot before, who were basically there to kind of support their husbands or maybe because a loved one kind of forced them into it. But we hope that maybe we made a difference, maybe even a small difference, maybe a small inspiration to help them understand that the 2A lifestyle is a normal everyday part of American life, and it should be a normal everyday part of a woman's life especially. One of the highlights, I think, for me was just meeting all the wonderful supporters of the Second Amendment. It was great to meet the leaders and the innovators and all the celebrities and trainers. I mean, even Dr. John Lott was there and sharing such powerful information, and George Harris was there. And I mean, these trainers are just absolutely phenomenal, but meeting just the everyday people who are living their everyday lives and who have been inspired by things that we've shared or said or by someone in the industry or even by a neighbor or a family member. Their stories were amazing. One lady especially brought me to tears. And I hope that at some point in the near future, she will give me the opportunity to get a little deeper into her actual story and what happened to her. But it basically just showed me the power of determination, the power of faith, and the idea that no matter what you've been through, or what your background is, or what your belief system is, or even what your political or religious affiliation might be, the 2A community is welcoming. The 2A community is responsible. We have fantastic people who are helpful and wanting other people to become part of this family. But also that it doesn't take a story. It doesn't take an incident. It doesn't really take anything at all except for the belief in yourself that you can do this and the belief that you are worth protecting. All in all, the weekend was absolutely amazing. And we are already looking forward to the next Concealed Carry Expo that will be taking place in Louisville, Kentucky. Plans, believe it or not, are already underway. So for those in that area or for anyone who's interested, we'd love to see you there. Thanks for letting me share about this fantastic concealed carry experience. And until next time, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the Donate or Subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Father accused of fatally stabbing two daughters.
Okay, Sean, look, I know that you're trying to sound energized, but when we do one of these and it's about a horrific crime against children, could you maybe sound a bit more somber?
Okay, I'll give it a try. Felons behaving badly. Father accused of fatally stabbing two daughters. Does that work better?
Yes, it does.
A North Carolina man has been arrested on two counts of first-degree murder for allegedly stabbing his 4-day-old and a 2-year-old daughter to death, according to local authorities. This is how bad it is. It's suspect 30 was arrested Friday on two counts of child endangerment and two counts of child abuse following the disappearance of the girls while their mother, who is not named in reports, was at a hospital, according to the Fayetteville Observer and the Hoke County Sheriff's Office. Hoke County Sheriff's Office Sheriff Hubert Peterkin told the Fayetteville Observer that the girls' bodies were found around 2 a.m. Saturday inside a parked car in a wooded area in the Rayford area, which is about 35 minutes outside of Fayetteville. Suspect was then subsequently charged with the murder counts, the Hoke County Sheriff's Office said in a statement. It was horrific, Peterkin told the Fayetteville Observer, adding that the children appeared to have been stabbed multiple times with a survivalist type or hunting knife. From what our investigation's telling us, they had a dispute where the suspect allegedly made accusations about the babies not being his, a child not being his, or maybe her involvement with someone. And when he took the kids, we understand he left in a rage, Peterkin told ABC 11. It's kind of hard to find the words to describe what this feels like, Peterkin told ABC 11. I know people read it, I know people see the story and hear about it, but to be out here on the scene and actually see this stuff, to see the children lifeless and brutally stabbed, I don't care how many years you've been in it, how many times you've seen it or seen things, this was not a good experience, he said. Everybody's taking this real hard. Our heart goes out to the family, to the mother. I feel sad and hurt, but there's nothing I can do about it, a relative of the slain children told ABC 11. It is not known at this time whether suspect has entered a plea.
Okay, so obviously, this being America, someone is innocent until proven guilty. I get that. In a case like this, after conviction, I firmly believe that we need to do something to send a message. Like, I don't know, have the perpetrator beaten to death with a baseball bat or something. Just, oh God, this should not be tolerated. And I know, because he's going to jail, as a society, we technically aren't tolerating it, but just, oh, Jesus. Do not like.
I guess the question everybody has is what sort of person has a dispute with the mother, perhaps questioning the paternity of the children that he has been told are his kids? What sort of person has this argument, and then his response is to leave with the children in a rage and then stab them to death?
Now, see, that's overcomplicated. The question here is, what kind of waste of flesh and oxygen thief would murder children?
Well, he's not been convicted of this particular crime, but I can tell you what he's already been convicted of. Worthless check, misdemeanor, class 2. Drug paraphernalia, use, possess, misdemeanor, class 1. Larceny, misdemeanor, class 1. Maintain any place, controlled substance, misdemeanor, class 1. Breaking and entering vehicles, felon, class I. Credit card theft, felon, class I. Felony breaking and entering conspiracy, felon, class I. 3 counts, felony breaking and entering, felon, class H. 2 counts, larceny after breaking and entering, felon, class H. obtain property by false pretense, attempted, felon class H, assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury, felon class E, robbery with a dangerous weapon, conspiracy, felon class E, and robbery with a dangerous weapon, attempted, felon class D. Baron is on assignment and will return soon. Politicians forget they are public servants, not public masters. Miguel discusses one way to whip them into line.
Hello again, this is Miguel from the Gun Free Zone blog. In today's episode, we are going to talk about the need to keep your politicians properly whipped. 50 shades of I'm gonna bust your ass. In case you haven't heard, we in Florida recently got invaded by a GOP state senator under the name of Annie Terry Flores, who suddenly decided, after many years of voting the right way, to place her bets with Moms Demand. You know, Moms Demand, the same people that are, you know, wholly incorporated subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg in every town for gun safety and illegal mayors trying to keep guns from people. So for whatever reason, in the middle of a session, she got up and said that she was going to block every single pro-gun bill coming to discussion. That was a bomb. Nobody expected that. You're gonna hear, you know, some people, yeah, I knew. No, that nobody knew. But still, the damage was done. Unless something magical happens and Senator President Joe Negron grows a pair, we are screwed. We are screwed in Florida for the year. Now, the two bills we wanted to have was open carry and the elimination of gun-free zones. We are pretty much screwed. So, what happened? Now, this shit happens when you are being nice to politicians and you treat them like they were humans and they were aware of the concept of honor. At best, politicians are cattle and need to be moved and prodded with, you know, those little prong thingies with, okay, that kind of thing. And so they don't crap all over the place. That could be a little bit too much. You know, okay, you know, politicians are not cattle. They're fucking hamsters. Okay, their brains are so fucking small, they need to be retrained constantly. Lest they forget, you know, who puts them in the legislature. Now, I imagine you saying right now, God damn, Miguel, you're being harsh. I'm being harsh? No. Come on, you're going to tell me how the fuck this stupid senator forgot that we got rid of Miguel Diaz de la Portilla from Coral Gables because last session he pulled the same one? I mean, this guy had the full support of Moms Demand. They gave him money. And the guy still lost. Not because people voted against him. It's simply because gun owners decided not to vote for him. He lost to a freaking newbie Democrat. And he lost Coral Gables, which, you guys don't know, it is one of the richest parts of the Miami-Dade County. We're talking about all the multi-million dollar apartments and condos. It's there. So it cost them. We know it cost them money. Now, we need to change the way that we rate our senators and legislators. I understand that the NRA rating was, you know, the model, but we have to change. You know, we have been paying with votes for product that has not been delivered. That is not how we do things in this country. We give more support, we give more money, we give more vote, and they don't deliver. That's what happened this session. And I'm talking about the whole GOP, not just one or two senators or congressmen or congresswomen. So what we need to do is flip around, Estelle. The GOP, the Florida GOP, and obviously your GOP, whatever the hell who's voting is, you are going to get our votes, our support, our money, if and only if we see bills put at the governor's desk. Not that we're going to bring the bill, not that it's going to be voted on, then it failed, you know, in the floor. No. You don't get my support, you don't get my vote, you don't get my money unless bills are done, finished, and delivered to the governor. Till that the governor signs or doesn't sign, okay, that's going to be another issue. But at least I want to see my legislature delivering good program bills, and I mean good, not with some stupid little crap the governor's going to, you're going to force the governor to veto, but good gun bills. This crap of paying for stuff we are not getting is ridiculous. People, they already now 14 or 15 states that have constitutional carry. There are 45 states that have open carry. What the hell is happening in Florida? Why are we, you know, suddenly becoming the New Jersey of the South? There's actually a bill in the legislature to ban assault weapons. Not only that, it's got sponsors. It's got several sponsors. This hasn't happened since the Clinton era. What the f*** is going on? Floridians, in particular, and everybody in general, put the pressure on your freaking legislatures. Talk to your local, your state gun organizations, and tell them, we simply are not going to pay unless we see product deliver. And the product we want to deliver is good gun bills on top of the governor's desk to be signed. That's it. Okay, guys, that is all for today. See you next week. Have fun. Bye.
Get more Miguel daily at gunfreezone.net.
This is Bob Main from the Handgun World podcast, reminding you that this podcast is a member of the Self Defense Radio Network. Check out all the great podcasts at selfdefenseradio.net.
The main topic. Well, it looks like the Senate went nuclear, Aaron.
Where's the kaboom? There was supposed to be an earth-shattering kaboom.
I don't know how that sounded in the microphone, but in my head, I make awesome bomb noises.
So, reading CNN, because that's what you do, right?
CNN, that bastion of right-wing knee-jerk information.
Exactly. The Clinton News Network is reporting, Senate GOP triggers nuclear option to break Democratic filibuster of Gorsuch. So obviously, this is going to happen before you listen to the podcast. But on Friday, they're going to have the confirmation vote itself, which is a simple majority vote. 51 votes, and he's in. Now, I'm really surprised about this for two good reasons. You know, number one, McConnell's got a spine built out of spaghetti. I didn't believe that they had, I don't know, the intestinal fortitude. Can we say it that way? I didn't think they had the intestinal fortitude to go through with this, especially when you get things like, I don't know, McCain and some other of these senators who are like, oh no, we can't do that. That would be wrecking the collegiality of the Senate to fight like this. We've got to lay down and take it when Chuck U. Schumer decides that he's going to beat us up. So number one, I'm surprised that the Republicans said, all right, screw it. We're going to do this. And if you don't like it, too bad. And number two, just tactically, this seems like a stupid move on the part of the Democrats. What sense does that make? To filibuster somebody that everybody says, no, this guy's great. You know, he's exactly what we're looking for. I mean, maybe you don't like his politics, but you don't have any real reason to say no to him.
Well, especially since when he was appointed to, what, the 10th Circuit, he was pretty much appointed unanimously. Everyone on both sides of the aisle was saying great things about him. So it really seems like their main objection isn't to him, but their objection is because he was appointed by Trump.
You know, I think that's it right there. But see, even if you think it would be a good idea to get even with somebody, you know, if that's your whole point is I'm going to obstruct everything. I'm going to throw sand in the gears. I'm going to cause trouble. Does it make sense to do that when you know that the response is going to screw you down the line? Because that's what's going to happen. I mean, this is a guy who's a conservative judge, apparently, as far as we know, and he's going to replace Antonin Scalia. So it doesn't affect the, what's a good way to put this? It's not, it doesn't
balance
affect
of the court.
Yeah, the balance of the court. It doesn't really affect it so much. What happens when, say, Kennedy or Ginsburg or Breyer decide, you know what, I've had enough of this. The way the Democrats have been acting since the election, it's going to be 8 years of Trump, and they're probably at this point working on Pence getting reelected.
Not reelected.
Didn't I say reelected?
Well, no, you said working on getting Pence reelected.
Yeah, it's exactly what I mean. Say he's going to get elected. They're working on his second election.
Oh, okay. I understand now. So you're taking the first Pence administration as a given. I understand now.
So they're looking at a minimum at this point. I really don't, unless Trump does something. You know what? Even if Trump does something crazy, he's done crazy things. It's not changed anything. So how are they going to get rid of him? I mean, short of like bodily dragging him out, and that won't work. I mean, you figure the Secret Service would protect him physically, even if they can't keep his mouth shut. But seriously, does this make any sense? You're putting yourselves in the position, assuming, you know, as the Democrats, you're putting yourself in this position where now, let's say, Ginsburg, who's 84 years old and has been on the court for, I don't know, 20 some years,
Well, she was a Clinton appointee, so there you go.
23 years. She's been on the court for 23 years and 7 months at the time we're recording now. And yeah, it was a Clinton appointee. If she just doesn't feel like going on any further, or she gets sick, God forbid she die, let's say that something happens to her. Well, now what you've done is you've opened the door for Trump to just appoint anybody he wants. And as long as the Republicans are cool with it, you can't stop it. This was a case of hold your fire on somebody that realistically, they got no dirt on this guy. They got nothing on him. The latest scandal is that he may have plagiarized something in his book or paper or whatever it was. And one of the so-called victims of the plagiarism scandal is like, no, you guys are just unaware of how this is done. And no, it's not plagiarism. So, I mean, they got no dirt on this guy.
Yeah, that, and when they pressed him for questions, his fallback answer was not to give his opinion, but to state what the law said.
That's terrible. What was he thinking?
I know.
This just seems tactically stupid, right? You know, I see a large animal that could eat me. I'm going to go in and bop it on the nose to tell it who's boss. Are you stupid? You know, wait for the actual problem to happen and then fight it there, right? You know, why do you start trouble when you aren't going to be able to finish trouble, right? You just basically screwed yourself.
Yeah.
Let's say the next person that Trump appoints, somebody like Robert Bork, like really divisive. People don't like him. Well, now they have to hope that they can convince McCain or somebody like him to go, no, I can't in good conscience vote for this person. Because, I mean, you'd at least think the next time, you know, if this happened, you know, here we get some ultra conservative person who's replacing Ginsburg or, you know, maybe Breyer or somebody like that. Those guys, you know, Breyer's 78. Kennedy's 80. Kennedy's sort of the swing vote. Any of those people get replaced, like the three oldest people on the court, any of them get replaced, it really changes the balance of the court. You could possibly make the case that this is a bad idea, but you're not going to because nobody cares at this point. There's nothing you can do. You can stand there and say stop, or I'll say stop again. It just seemed tactically stupid. I mean, what do you get out of this that it made sense to die on this particular hill?
Yeah, that I don't know. But let me tell you what I find interesting. The same sort of people who were complaining in the election that the popular vote should elect the president are now the same people who are decrying that the popular vote shouldn't be used to determine a justice.
There's a lot of people that don't want to be consistent, and that doesn't even possibly surprise me. I mean, it's just, I'm 47. I know better than to expect any sort of consistency out of these people on either side. I mean, I'm not pointing the fingers at one side or the other. They're all inconsistent. They just say whatever they think is going to get them the furthest. Maybe that makes me cynical.
Well, how do you know a politician is lying?
His mouth is moving. And you know what? It's not even true. He could be typing with his mouth shut.
So, you know he's lying because he's breathing.
Because he's a politician. Or she. Or other. You know, they're politicians. That's what they do. What can we say?
Tiffany is on assignment and will return next week.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, every pony. It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette.
Over the years, the Blue Collar Prepping blog has talked about some subjects which, while not illegal themselves, could certainly aid in illegal activities. For example, and very relevant to our discussion at the top of the show, last year Chaplain Tim talked about lockpicking, and just this past Thursday, he talked about how to siphon gasoline from underground storage tanks as a way to fuel your vehicle after a disaster. Like Tim, I believe there's no such thing as inherently bad knowledge, for the same reason that I believe there's no such thing as an inherently bad tool. It's what we do with those tools, or that knowledge, that matters. There's also the fact that in a life-or-death situation, it is permitted to break a law when following it would cause more human injury than breaking it. This is known as the doctrine of competing harms here in the United States, although it is sometimes called the doctrine of necessity or the doctrine of two evils. For example, if you are lost in the woods and you are in danger of dying from exposure or dehydration, It is legally defensible for you to break into an unoccupied cabin in order to save your own life, because a human life is more precious in the eyes of the law than personal property. You can get in out of the cold, you can build a fire, you can even drink their water and eat their food, because this trespassing and burglary is being done to save a life, yours. However, it's not legally defensible for you to then ransack that cabin or take items from it. Once you are out of danger, anything else you do is prosecutable. Now, some of you are likely wondering, well, this is all very well and good, Aaron, but what does this have to do with prepping? And the answer to that is ethics. Here's an example of ethical lockpicking. You come across that same unoccupied cabin in the woods, and you're going to die of exposure if you don't get shelter and warmth. You could just break the lock or smash a window to get inside, but it's actually more ethical to pick that lock because it doesn't destroy the cabin owner's property. It's also ethical and really good manners to leave a note with your name and contact information explaining what you did and why and what you used and offering to compensate the owner for loss and damages. Not only is this the decent thing to do, but it also gives you an affirmative defense against charges of trespassing, burglary, and theft in case the owner has the police come out and investigate the break-in. Similarly, if you are a prepper who owns such a cabin, it is ethical to keep it unlocked and stocked with food, water, and firewood in case someone is stranded and needs shelter. That's a common practice in Alaska and many parts of Canada, and I've heard it done as far south as upstate New York. Remember, the entire point of prepping is to prevent suffering and death. Clearly, your own well-being comes before that of others, but if your life isn't on the line, for example, you aren't currently living in that cabin, then your concern should be for other innocent people. I will admit that things become a bit fuzzy if that cabin is your bug-out location and is filled with your preps, because in that case, anything which is taken by a stranger in need is conceivably being taken from you when you might need them in the future. This is made even fuzzier if you keep firearms among your preps. In a situation like that, what I recommend is a bit of misdirection. Leave the door unlocked and some basic staples like food, water, and blankets for such a lost soul, but keep your main preps both hidden and locked up. Good places to hide your preps are under the floorboards, buried a few feet underground, or concealed nearby under a camouflage tarp or otherwise made to look like part of the terrain. Whichever you choose, it's important to make sure that these preps are sealed tightly. Not only will this prevent damage from moisture, but a tight seal will lock in odors that might attract hungry wildlife. Next week, I'll talk about the best containers for such storage.
Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. What kind of person would feel that guns should be banned and gays should be defenseless? Why, Dwight Panazzo of Gays Against Guns, that's who. Weird takes a closer look at one of the hosts of the Loaded Conversations podcast in This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
So this week, I'll be taking on another of the regular panelists on the only anti-gun podcast, the Loaded Conversations podcast. Dr. Dwight Panazzo is the president of Gays Against Guns New Jersey, as well as the president of the New Jersey Brady Campaign. The show I'm grabbing these clips from is the episode where they interview Scottish anthropologist Joe Anderson about his PhD study on the United States gun culture. Amazingly, I really enjoyed listening to Joe talk, as while he doesn't much care for guns, nor does he disagree with the UK's gun laws, he is really studying the issue with a level head and a lot of respect. Of course, the peanut gallery in the show behaved as expected. First, we have Rebecca of the Ohio Brady Campaign listening to Joe relate his experience with cowboy action shooting in California.
So what are they shooting?
So they're shooting old-style West guns. So like old-fashioned revolvers and lever-action rifles and things like that.
Like targets?
At like metal targets. Yeah, they're like metal targets. And they make a kind of ping sound, which is very satisfying when they hit.
Do they hire other kids from the neighborhood to play the Indians?
It's not quite that colonial, no.
So this is his second explanation of the sport. I really think Rebecca heard cowboy and shooting and just assumed it was men in the desert having honest-to-God showdowns with live ammo. Notice how even when she hears for the second time that the competitors are shooting steel, she has to ask if they hire kids to play the Indians. When I say anti-gun nuts, I mean it. She really is thinking that people are shooting other people for sport at gun clubs, and somehow this isn't the lead story of every newscast. This is where her mind naturally goes. But this show is really the show for Dwight Panozzo to shine. He asks this very leading question.
Have you considered the character traits of the population you're working with? And I don't mean the LGBT population. I'm thinking of those post-retirement age males who I'm going to go out on a limb and guess are also predominantly white.
Yes.
Probably predominantly working class. There's probably a negative correlation with years of education.
Can you guess what Dwight thinks of gun owners?
I would not say working class.
Okay.
Because in California, it's interestingly more wealthy people that are into these sort of sports, as far
really?
As I can tell from
my interesting. Research. Well, the sample is not representative.
In Massachusetts, my experiences are generally the same. Gun owning isn't a cheap hobby. Even a very inexpensive High Point will set you back over $100. Plus, if you want to shoot, you'll need ammo, ear and eye protection, etc. In Massachusetts, to own, you also need to apply for your permit, take a safety class, and often become a member of a shooting club. Even if your chief doesn't ask to see a membership before he'll issue a card, if you want to shoot your guns, you'll likely need to do it at a club. All those costs add up fast, and before you know it, you're looking at a lot of money. Money the poor working class doesn't have. Now, in my home state of Maine, as well as other gun-friendly states I've spent time in, the experience is a little different. It isn't Dwight's experience of old, stupid white men. Okay, he didn't say it, but he makes it pretty clear that's what he was thinking. But really, just a cross-section of everybody. The poor shift worker might have some family heirlooms or a cheap gun they bought from a friend or a gun shop or traded for. People with more disposable money are more likely to have more guns. When on a whim, you can stop at the local gun store just to check it out, and the law says you can legally buy whatever you want, you may find yourself an hour later walking out with an AR or a pistol that you never planned on buying that morning. You'll find that even people who you'd never think might own guns might have a gun or two in their house. And while the main gun owners I know are mostly white, though I know quite a few gun-owning Native Americans, that's because Maine is a mostly white state. And as your gun-friendly state becomes more diverse, the demographics of gun owners changes respectively. Of course, in gun-unfriendly states like Massachusetts and New Jersey, it becomes even harder to become a gun owner if you're a person of color. Here in Mass, the lily-white suburbs are very gun-friendly. But a few towns over, in a town with a large black or Hispanic population, you'll find a police chief who doesn't like to issue permits. Funny how that works. You think that was bad? Just wait till you hear this story.
I went to a Sportsmen's Association / NRA convention day out on Long Island in the fall.
And you dropped your purse, right?
Oh, honey, I dropped my purse and one of the nice post-retirement age retirees. It's not a fucking purse, it's my wallet. I dropped my wallet. But this nice old man said to me from the row behind, "Excuse me, did you drop your wallet?" And I said, "Oh yeah, that's mine." And had he not done that, I would have been really screwed because I'd be, you know, basically 75 miles from home, you know, without any money, without any identification, surrounded by people I loathe.
This is Gun Owners. Note that Dwight is very much an openly gay man. Enough that there is a very good chance that the man talking to him either knew or suspected he was gay. And that didn't change anything. Yet, whose heart is full of hate? Dwight. The nice man pointed out I dropped my wallet, and I was surrounded by people I loathe. That's some thanks.
It helped me to humanize these people a lot, to understand that, you know, these are tend to be very law-abiding citizens who also tend to be highly conservative. They tend to have a very shaky grasp on aspects of reality.
Humanize these people. Literally, in Dwight's world, gun owners are not humans. As Sean said before, we're orcs to them. The conservative angle makes sense. He was at a Friends of the NRA event, meaning that the people there felt that guns and the Second Amendment were very important. Democrats in general, and especially the Democrats in the Northeast, are doing everything in their power to take all the guns away. Air rifles are considered firearms in New Jersey. As for law-abiding, we have to be. If we break the law, we may lose our guns. It all makes perfect sense to me. Why does Dwight think we don't have a grasp on reality? Or is this a textbook case of psychological projection?
That's what I would expect, because my guess is they're, to a far greater extent than the general population, pricks. They're interpersonally very challenging to be around. They're very obsessive compulsive in their habits. Not a big surprise. Nobody f-ing wants to be around them, and very few of them are running to the soup kitchen to donate their time.
Wow. He goes on about how much he loathes gun owners and how crazy and non-human they are, and then calls us pricks. So in contrast, I put a video of Dwight and his compatriots holding a protest at the New Jersey State Fair. Gays Against Guns dress in white clothes and veils and stand silently while others read propaganda. They did this in front of the NRA booth at the fair. This is how all their protests look. This is New Jersey. It didn't become so anti-gun by accident. Why on earth would they be rallying as the antagonist rather than trying to win friends and influence other anti-gun people who maybe haven't done any work as activists? At the end of the video, they were ejected from the fair because they hadn't cleared their protest with the fair, and the NRA was a paying customer. We're the pricks? Also, how often do you hear antis complaining about a charity raffle where a gun's being auctioned off? Has he not heard of open carry litter cleanups? And this is the blatant Second Amendment charity work. We don't necessarily feel the need to drape ourselves with NRA gear as we ladle food at the homeless shelter or donate time and money to charitable causes.
The clientele that I see here in my office, they tend to be very selfish. They'll be right there telling you about why they should have gun rights. And then if you have them explain to you how they're preventing people from being killed by gun violence, they seem to double right back on why they should have gun rights. And it's like, no, you seem to have missed the point.
So for those who don't know, Dwight is a licensed clinical social worker. I won't give out his practice address, but he runs DwightPanazzoPhD.com, so it's not like it's a secret. It's hard to tell specifics about his gun-owning clients, since we're only hearing one side of the story from a man who clearly doesn't see the world the same way we do. But how relevant are his anti-gun talking points to the service he's providing? This is why Floridians passed the Docs versus Glocks gag law. It wasn't silencing doctors. It was simply setting boundaries after a large number of complaints were filed by patients that had been subjected to anti-gun propaganda by doctors they were seeing for unrelated medical issues. Dwight is the president of a Gays Against Gun chapter and a Brady campaign chapter, and he's lecturing patients on gun ownership. Think about the conflict of interest there. This next bit is about concealed carry.
They are self-deputized. I don't want them protecting me. I want to hire plenty of cops and have lots of gun legislation and gun policy to protect me. I don't want renegades out there protecting me. They seem to miss that part.
Guess what, Dwight? I don't carry a gun to protect you. There's a common saying in the self-defense crowd, never pull your gun for anyone you aren't willing to go to jail for. If you need to pull your gun, even if it's a clear-cut case of self-defense, there still might be an overzealous prosecutor who might try to make an example of you. See George Zimmerman for an example. So generally, it's ill-advised to pull a gun in self-defense of a total stranger. Also, Dwight, do you know who else has no obligation to keep you safe? The police. Go look up Warren versus District of Columbia, where it was ruled that police were under no obligation to protect victims of violent crime from harm. Because of that, and the fact that when seconds count, the police are minutes away, I'll carry my gun, thank you. I certainly respect your right to choose differently. But after all this talk about how guns are horrible and will bring death and destruction to all around you, how does he feel about gays who are arming up in reaction to the election of Donald Trump?
I'm reticent to tell people not to protect themselves from crazy white people. Crazy white, deeply privileged people who don't see a goddamn bit of their privilege, but act out of it every moment of their lives.
Isn't that what you just said not to do? Also, can you taste the irony of this being said by an angry, hateful white man with multiple advanced degrees? Either way, I respect anybody's right to keep and bear arms, no matter what their political ideology. I'm disgusted with his race targeting. Just as I'd be disgusted if someone said they were arming up against crazy blacks or crazy Hispanics. That being said, if someone wants to perpetrate violence against you, I support your right to defend yourself. Unfortunately, people like Dwight have worked very hard to make the state of New Jersey blind to that right.
Have you considered what you have done to yourself in this ethnographic process that you are immersing yourself in?
Here's his closing remarks to Joe the researcher. It's more dehumanizing talk. I mean, you can't rub elbows with gun owners without it tainting you somehow, right?
Joe gets to go home at the end of this and take a really long shower.
A long, hot shower. A sanitizing shower.
Oh my God.
Yep. We're just dirty and we need to be washed away. Doctor, heal thyself. Because Dr. Dwight Panazzo, PhD, seems incapable of arguing in good faith.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Plug of the week, the SFD responder. Now, Sean, I remember you talking about this on the podcast about a month ago, and you've been wearing it pretty much nonstop. So how's that working out for you?
It's been working pretty well. I just looked it up, and of course, since I track the dog walking miles, though I don't report on it much, I still track all of my dog walking miles, and I wear this whenever I'm walking the dog because, of course, I've got pants and shoes on. So I'm wearing it, and I've walked probably 115 or 120 miles just in dog walks with this on, and I wear it every day at work, so wherever I happen to walk there too. So anytime I've got shoes on, I wear this. The SFD responder is basically an ankle holster for medical gear. I imagine you can put other things in it, but it's really intended for your medical gear. It's $60. It's a slightly more expensive if you get like a camouflage one. I'm not sure why you would because it's under your pants, but if you like camouflage, there you go. Pay a little extra. Itself is $60, but when you fill it up with all the recommended gear, it's going to run you $180. So it's quite expensive to carry all this medical gear, but it's like a gun, you know? You don't need it until you need it, and when you need it, it's the only thing you need.
Less expensive than a second chest wound.
Or a spurting artery, yeah. So in it, I've got a tourniquet. I've got two chest seals. It's got hemostatic gauze like Quick Clot or Cheeto gauze. I've got a mini compression bandage. I've got a pair of rubber gloves. I have a mini rescue hook knife. I don't have a Sharpie, but I'm thinking seriously I should put some sort of a writing implement in there. And I'm also, in this case, I'm carrying a flashlight. I have my $15 Streamlight Stylus Pro. I didn't include that in the $180. But tourniquets and hemostatic gauze, that stuff's expensive. But if you need it, you need it. This all started with, I don't know, a couple of months, maybe a year ago, I started hearing from Tam and a lot of the people who train very seriously, oh, you need to carry a tourniquet. You need to carry a tourniquet. You need to carry a tourniquet. And I'm like, where am I going to carry a tourniquet? Am I going to like turn it into a necklace and carry it around my neck? I'm like, I just don't have room on my belt anymore. I'm like, I got to sit down. I mean, if I never sat down, then it wouldn't matter how much stuff I have my belt, right? I mean, I'm starting to look like Batman here. So, I mean, where am I going to carry this thing? Oh, well, you can put it on this paddle thing that you can stretch it out flat and it looks like a cell phone carrier. I'm like, oh, seriously? Or you can stick it in your pocket. Well, yeah, until I leave it in the pocket and then the wife yells at me for leaving stuff in my pockets. Just, you know, because she's washing the clothes and now I've got, you know, the rubber bands and whatever else is in it. And now do I know that the tourniquet actually works after it's gone through the dryer? I don't know. I don't know if they're designed to handle that. So I never carried one. I had one in the car. But what if I'm not near my car? So I thought about it and thought about it. Well, a couple of months ago, Mike Seeklander started talking about it on his podcast. Hey, I've got this thing. It's the SFD responder and I carry medical gear. And I'm like, oh, that sounds good. I carry it on my ankle. And I said, you know what? I have two ankles and there's nothing on either of them. I could put one there. That would be awesome. So I looked it up and I thought about it. I mean, you know, that's a good idea. And I've always wanted, you know, since I understand, hey, having a tourniquet's a great idea. As Tam says, there's a non-zero chance, since I'm carrying a gun, that somebody's going to get shot, right? And statistically, who's the most dangerous person to you when you're carrying a gun? You are, right? The average person on the street is no danger to you at all, and the likelihood of getting robbed or something like that is pretty small, but I'm handling a gun every day. So there's a non-zero chance that I'll shoot myself, and it'd be nice not to bleed to death from that sort of a mistake. So it's a great idea. I'm like, and this is finally a way to carry it. Now, I've been carrying it for a month like this, and I got to tell you, the stuff is high quality. My parents used to run a commercial sewing shop. I did a little work, you know, putting zippers on and stuff like that when I was a kid. So I know what good sewing quality looks like. Maybe not as good as my mom knows, but still, I can look at something after I've worn it on my ankle for at least 110 miles of walking, probably closer to 120, 130 at this point, and it's not falling apart. The stitching is good. There's no signs of wear on it. It's a high quality piece of equipment. So check it out. It's saferfasterdefense.com and just look for the SFD responder. It's $60. And like I said, if you like camouflage, you can pay a little extra.
Yeah, I never saw the point in camouflaging your medical gear, because if the camouflage works like it's intended to and you put it down, you might have a hard time finding it, or you might be delayed in looking for it. I think emergency gear should be a bright color so you can find it quickly.
Right. Of course, when you're getting shot at, you really don't want anybody to see it. So I guess if that's important to you, you can get it camouflaged. But I just got basic black for $60.
And just in case anyone's interested, I am also carrying a tourniquet. I just have mine on my belt behind my spare magazines.
Well, there you go.
Don't forget to order your Gunblog Variety Cast patch. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and look on the top of the right sidebar. If we get 20 people within this week, then I will buy the patches. If we don't get 20 people, then I'm going to refund the money to those who have already ordered them. Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that the Gunblog Variety Cast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode138.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you. This is a URS production.